like some two minor lines. Justifies presence here for this here a sheet of paper so that you can put your name on it and also tell us whether you wished it, a certificate in Catalan or in Spanish, in English or in different languages. We are multilingual. And second point is that since courses at this university are in progress now, we have today some difficulty with this classroom, so that we must be strict this morning, just this morning, very strict. Professor Chomsky will talk till 12:05, and then 12, and then we'll have a discussion till just half an hour after that, so that 12:35, and then at 12:35 we must leave the room. Till 4 o'clock. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, we'll continue the experiment. I think a little improvement, but not a lot. Yesterday, I outlined what seems to me the natural course, the proper course for a naturalistic theory of language. I didn't sketch in any details. I hope we can come back to that later. It seems to me a model of what naturalistic inquiry should be with regard to any aspect of what the phenomena that fall into the traditional domain of the mental. And again, I stress that there's no metaphysical distinction between these and others, although there may well be an epistemological distinction in that these phenomena may, to a certain extent, maybe a crucial extent, be beyond the cognitive reach of a particular creature, namely us. They might be mysteries for us, a conclusion which would not be terribly surprising. I also described a bit how the collapse of any naturalistic variety of dualism, for example, the Cartesian variety, these collapsed with Newton's demonstration that the ghostly properties of mind pervade the entire world, that is, that these are that matter as well, down to the level of elementary mechanics, also has what are ghostly properties from the point of view of the traditional mechanical philosophy, which is a rather good expression of our common sense view of nature. With that discovery, we abandon the common sense view, at least for the purposes of theoretical inquiry, and we move to an intellectual stage where we search for the best theoretical explanation without any expectation any longer that it will conform to our intuitions or to our intuitive requirements, which simply are another phenomenon of nature that have to be explained. Well, I'll come back to further spelling out of the naturalistic point of view, that's the substantive part. But what I want to do now is to, I ended yesterday by saying that I would like to turn to approaches to the mental that reject the entirely the naturalistic approach that I sketched yesterday and insist on a kind of a radical dualism. Now, since this isn't any longer metaphysical dualism, it's a kind of methodological or epistemological dualism. Now, I stress that advocates of the positions that I'm describing would never accept this characterization of what they're doing. On the contrary, they consider themselves hard-headed scientists pursuing naturalistic inquiry in its most perfect and advanced character, but I think when I will try to show, in fact, that what they are adopting is a form of radical dualism and a form that is completely irrational and untenable. And furthermore, I'll try to show that this is extremely pervasive. In fact, it includes virtually all of the more considered, reflective, thoughtful work on the cognitive sciences, on philosophy of mind, again, excluding the actual experimental work, which goes on, you know, with such successes as it has. Well, I mentioned yesterday that in principle we could have two people, call them Peter and Mary, and Peter and Mary might have arrived at two different I languages, let's say L1 and L2, and it might turn out that L1 and L2 have the same extension, that is, they generate the same set of linguistic expressions. That's a possibility, a theoretical possibility. It would arise from the fact that they had received a somewhat different arrangement of data, and that data had led their common language faculty to slightly different conclusions, which just happened to coincide in the linguistic expressions that they form. Now, it may be, and in fact very likely is true, that in the real world that can't happen, because the language faculty is so restrictive that it excludes this possibility. But that's an empirical issue. It has to do with the narrowness of the language faculty and the limits of the kinds of languages that it makes possible. Conceptually, there's nothing surprising about this. Very well turn out to be the case. Now, what I've just said is commonly regarded to be completely meaningless and absurd. There's a major current of modern philosophy which considers this comment simply an absurdity. The reason is that having the same linguistic expressions means having essentially the same behavior. The way you speak, the way you understand, depends on the linguistic expressions, the collections of phonetic and semantic properties. And if two people have the same collection of expressions, they're going to react the same way to what they hear, and they're going to express themselves the same way, and over some large range of behavior, they'll be indistinguishable. And since they'll be indistinguishable over a large range of behavior, the theory has it that it is unintelligible to attribute to them different states of mind, because the states of mind that we attribute to them are just a characterization of the range of behavior that that they undergo, that they exhibit. Similarly, suppose that in the case of Mary, I have a choice, given a fixed set of linguistic expressions, I have a choice between assigning to her language L2 or language L3, let's say, which differ in the set of linguistic expressions, or are the same, it doesn't really matter. In fact, I can put this aside. I might have it, as a scientist, I might not be certain from the data available to me whether to assign to Mary L2 or L3. Let's say, for concreteness, that they still generate the same set of linguistic expressions. And that would remain the case even if I had a theory of what's called universal grammar, that is, a theory of the language faculty, which is the same thing. Recall that the language faculty is the fixed species-specific system that permits Peter and Mary and everyone else to take certain data and to form in the mind an I language. Suppose that I have two different theories of the linguistic faculty. One of them would lead me to conclude that Mary has L2. The other one would lead me to conclude that Mary has L3. Okay, so I have theory, let's call it theory 2, which would lead me to conclude that Mary has L2, and I have theory 3 of the language faculty, which would lead me to conclude that Mary has L3. And we're assuming that they happen to converge on the set of linguistic expressions. Suppose I discover that there's somebody else, call him Wang, who speaks Chinese, and he Wang gets certain data. Wang has the same brain that we have. We know that. There's no genetic adaptation to learning Chinese. In the case of Wang, suppose that theory T2 allows me to explain how Wang gets his knowledge from the data, but theory T3 doesn't allow me to explain that. If I assume that the language faculty is described by T3, and then I look at Wang, and I look at his data, and I assume that this is T3, then I come out with some I language, whatever it is, let's call it L4, which just happens to be the wrong one. I can tell by looking at Wang's behavior that it's the wrong one. It generates the wrong expressions. On the other hand, if I pick T2, then I apply it to Wang, I get some other language, which in fact is actually Chinese, and it comes out right. Okay. Now, for any scientist, any natural scientist, that would tell us that for Mary, we have to pick L2, not L3. The reason is that L2 is consistent with a more general theory of the language faculty that explains Wang as well, whereas L3 is inconsistent with that theory and is only consistent with the theory of the language faculty, which makes wrong predictions for Wang. Okay, the logic is quite straightforward, and in the natural sciences would be totally uncontroversial. However, we are instructed by philosophers that this is impermissible in the special case of language. We are not allowed to choose L2 for Mary in preference to L3 on the basis of the fact that if we choose L2, we can also explain Wang. The language that we assign to Mary has to be based solely on Mary's behavior, not on Wang's behavior. Okay. Wang's behavior is irrelevant in principle to attributing a language, often called a grammar in the literature, attributing an I language, a grammar, to Mary. That's the instruction that is handed down by the contemporary philosophical tradition. Now, this is very curious. Let's proceed. The most prominent advocate of this position, the person who more or less established contemporary analytic philosophy, for which this is a crucial principle, is Van Quine, who spoke here a couple of years ago. And Quine actually takes a still stronger position. He says that if Peter and Mary, if L1 and L2 generate the same formal language, remember that there's another notion here, formal language, which is class of well-formed expressions. And there's some problems about this. Nobody knows what it is. But let's put those aside. Let's pretend that we know what the formal language is. Well, clearly you can have different classes of expressions that coincide in their signals. They differ in all sorts of other respects, okay? Like they differ in how they associate signals with semantic properties and so on. But you could have many, many different sets of expressions which coincide with the same set of well-formed expressions, with signals, in other words, if we knew what the set was. We don't, but pretending we do. According to Quine's version, if Mary and Peter correspond in their formal languages, in the well-formed expressions, the signals that they accept, then we are not permitted to assign a different... it makes no sense to say that one rather than another I language is true of Mary and Peter, and we're certainly not allowed to assign different ones to Mary and Peter. Similarly, a fortiori, we're not allowed to consider anything about Wang. That's Quine's version of this. As he puts it, if two grammars, grammar's just a term for I language, if two grammars are extensionally equivalent, meaning they're the same with regard to formal language, then it is meaningless to claim that one rather than another grammar is in the mind of the speaker. And a fortiori, it's methodologically wrong to appeal to the fact that one decision will allow us to explain Wang, whereas the other decision will leave Wang unexplained. We're not allowed to do that either, because only the class of I language, of formal expressions, is allowed to, that's the database for the linguist in assigning a grammar. That's the theory. it has a kind of a motivation. The motivation is that the child learning the language only hears signals. And the child learning the language is picking up the eye language from the signals. And from that, Quine concludes that it is meaningless for the linguist who he identifies with the child. It's obviously a mistake, but he identifies the linguist with the child. It is meaningless for the linguist to assign different eye languages on the basis of the same set of signals when the child just does it whatever way he does. That's the underlying motivation. I'll spell it out as we proceed. Other followers of Quine, this is what's called the radical translation model, or has various other characterizations. Other followers of Quine, like, say, Donald Davidson, go even further than this, while accepting this much. Donald Davidson argues that it's a mistake to try to attribute mechanisms to the speaker. The claim that what underlies the behavior is some specific set of mechanisms. As he puts it, it adds nothing to the theory of meaning. That's just the philosopher's way of talking about the theory of language. It adds nothing to the theory of meaning to assume that some mechanisms correspond to the theory. So, for example, if one could find certain cellular mechanisms that are consistent with theory T1, but are not consistent with theory T2, that would be irrelevant in principle to the linguist. So the linguist is not permitted to look at other language. If I say I'm trying to determine Peter's eye language, all I'm allowed to look at is the set of signals that Peter accepts. Maybe, you know, if you can convince them that that's too narrow, the set of linguistic expressions that Peter has. I'm not allowed to go on to do what any scientist would do and ask whether one theory of the initial state is consistent with the biological mechanisms and another one isn't. I'm not allowed to ask whether one theory of the initial state is consistent with, say, Wang or Ahmed or, you know, Luigi or somebody speaking a different language. Those moves are excluded. They're barred to the linguist. The linguist is not permitted to study these aspects of the brain by the methods of the natural sciences. That's the theory. Well, presumably, somebody is allowed to study these aspects of the brain. That is, the injunction doesn't seem to be that no one is allowed to study them. I mean, presumably, somebody is allowed to study the mechanisms. Somebody is allowed to study the initial state and to make use of the fact that one theory of it accounts for Wang and another one doesn't. Somebody's allowed to study that, but not the linguist, by the philosopher's stipulation. Well, this is a pure terminological stipulation, obviously. So let's accept it. Who cares? We'll accept the terminology. Linguists are people who, by stipulation, are committed to total irrationality. They're not allowed to study any of the topics that anybody would investigate if they wanted to understand the nature of language. Now, having accepted that terminological stipulation, the rational move is to abandon completely the ridiculous pursuit that is now called linguistics and to turn to this other subject, whatever it is, in which we're allowed to look at Wang when we try to decide what's the right eye language for Peter, and we're allowed to look at biological phenomena if we can find any. In fact, we're allowed to do anything that any normal scientist would do. In fact, that happens to be the actual practice of linguists, which is condemned in this tradition of philosophy, which in a final irony prides itself on its naturalism and its adherence to the methods of the sciences. Now, this seems to me a case of quite radical dualism. And I stress, well, those of you who are philosophers will know, this is a highly influential tradition. In fact, it dominates a large part of contemporary philosophy of language and mind and feeds over into the cognitive sciences. It seems to be totally irrational. You know, it seems to be a pure irrational stipulation that a certain category in one building in the university, they're not allowed to study the brain for some reason. You've got to go to some other place, and there they can study it. And in that other department, they're allowed to do exactly what linguists are now doing, but they're not allowed to call themselves linguists. That's what it comes down to. So we can accept all that, recognizing that we haven't done anything except you know, moved around, made some moves. In fact, it's rather reminiscent of a comment that Voltaire once made about metaphysics. He said, it's a game with extremely elegant moves where you always end up where you started. You know, it's more or less accurate in this case. Now, Quine himself has a further extension of this curious theory. He is willing to accept the linguist, remember, is restricted to looking at signals. Okay, just which are the well-formed expressions? And maybe, I don't know why he wouldn't, he should go on at least to say the linguist is permitted to look at the way signals are associated with interpretations in a particular community, but he's not allowed to go any further than that. However, Quine, in more recent work, has been willing to accept certain other evidence that would be relevant, and it works like this. One problem that he discusses is the problem of how to assign phrase structure. So if you have a sentence like, say, John saw Bill, there's a question whether it's, say, three different phrases, and that's all there is, or whether it's two different phrases. Too many B's here. Or whether it has some other arrangement. But those are empirical questions that one might ask. Quine has argued that there's no choice, there's no truth of the matter with regard to this distinction. It's anything you decide. The reason is you get the same set of signals no matter which way you do it. Okay, and that's consistent with his terminological stipulation. However, more recently, he's been willing to accept the idea that some other kinds of evidence might lead you one way or the other. The other kind of evidence is what's called psychological evidence. Psychological evidence is distinguished throughout the tradition, including the cognitive sciences. It's distinguished from linguistic evidence. So linguistic evidence, for example, would be evidence about how people understand referential relations. Okay, it turns out, for example, that if you say he thinks John is intelligent, then in English, in fact, in every other language, we know that the person who says this sentence intends he to refer to someone other than John. Okay. On the other hand, if you say his mother thinks John is intelligent, then we don't know whether the speaker is referring to John when he uses he or whether he's referring to somebody else. So there's a difference between these two expressions. Well, evidence of this kind is called linguistic evidence, and there's a whole millions of, you know, huge amount of data of this kind. And it turns out if you use evidence of this kind across many different languages, you get quite strong arguments in favor of this analysis. It tells you this is the way it is, not that way. Then there's another class of evidence, which is called psychological evidence. An example of psychological evidence pairing on this is a set of experiments that were started by Tom Bever about 20 years ago, which refer to displacement, perceptual displacement of noises. So if you give a person a sentence, like say John saw Bill, some signal, and a person's listening to it, and you put in a noise, a click as it's called, in the course of the signal you introduce a click somewhere, and then you ask the person afterwards where they heard the click. Okay, you tell them, we ask them, where did you hear the click? What they will tend to do is to displace it to the phrase boundary. That is, they'll think they heard the click over here, even if in fact it appeared in the middle. Okay. So you tend to perceptually displace the click to the boundary of the phrases. Well, the click experiments support the idea that the big split is here, that the structure is AB, not ABC, or maybe a third possibility, you know, DE, split over here. You displace the click over here, not over here. Well, Quine has agreed that that kind of evidence the linguist is allowed to use. He's allowed to use psychological evidence to determine where the phrase boundary is, but he's not permitted to use linguistic evidence. evidence, say, about referential relations and tons of other evidence of that kind. Now, that, too, is a very curious move, for one thing, because from a scientific point, first of all, evidence doesn't come divided into categories. There's no such thing as linguistic evidence and psychological evidence. I mean, evidence doesn't come with a little tag on it which says, I'm linguistic evidence or I'm psychological evidence. Evidence is just evidence. In fact, it is data. It becomes evidence when you can interpret it within some sort of a theory. Otherwise, it's just, random data. So the distinction doesn't make any sense in the first place. But even granting the distinction, the story is backwards. The only significance to the click studies is that they correlate with the conclusions of linguists. The so-called linguistic evidence about the phrase boundary is vastly more convincing and persuasive on scientific grounds than the perceptual evidence. In fact, the perceptual evidence tells you nothing. From the fact that people displace the click to this boundary, you don't know whether that means the boundary's here or whether it means the boundary's here. I mean, maybe what people are doing is displacing the click to the middle of a phrase. Okay. Suppose people are displacing the click to the middle of a phrase. Well, then, these same data would tell you that the phrase boundary's got to be over here, because they displace the click, or they perceptually displace the click over here. Okay, so the data tells you nothing. I mean, the only reason why people like, say, Bever and Fodor and others have interpreted the data as supporting the phrase boundary between, say, subject and predicate is because that's what the linguistic evidence shows. And the linguistic evidence is really quite persuasive. Furthermore, there's a theory about it. It fits into a theory, so it has theoretical consequences, which means there's a whole mass of indirect evidence that supports it, including evidence from Chinese, let's say, and evidence from historical change and from child language and so on and so forth. The click evidence has nothing supporting it at all. It's just an observation, just kind of like an interesting piece of data, which becomes evidence because you can interpret it in terms of the much more firmly grounded linguistic theories. Now, this is from a naturalistic point of view. But Quine takes the opposite view. His view is that the psychological evidence you're allowed to appeal to it in determining the phrase boundary, although it in fact tells you absolutely nothing. It puts the phrase boundary here if you believe that people displace clicks to the boundary. It puts the phrase boundary here if you believe that people displace clicks to the middle of the phrase. And you can just as well believe one as the other, since there's no reason to believe either. There's no theory about it, in other words. Well, again, these moves are completely baffling from a naturalistic point of view. They make all kinds of distinctions that don't exist. They put matters on their head. They interpret the powerful evidence as weak evidence and the weak evidence as powerful evidence. In fact, they make no sense at all. Now, we can work out, as a kind of psychoanalysis, you can figure out where it comes from. I mean, it comes from a picture of science as something that's done by people who wear white coats and have equipment and do statistics and that sort of thing. Science isn't what people do when they sit around and think about the structure of sentences and, ask their friends what this means and so on. But that's, of course, just nonsense. I mean, the linguistic experiments on, say, referential dependence, if you wanted to, you could dress them up, too, with white coats and statistics and tachistoscopes and pushing buttons and equipment and so on and so forth. Nobody bothers to do it for a reason that's well understood in the natural sciences, which I mentioned yesterday. You never do experiments beyond the level of precision that's relevant to the questions you're asking. And the questions about phrase structure are well enough answered by the very reliable judgments about sentences like this, which indeed are extremely reliable. You can get those judgments from children. And you can get them with, they're repeatable. If you want, you could dress them up as more complicated experiments, but that would be as if a physicist were to carry out experiments, to the 10th decimal place when you don't understand the second decimal place. That would be pointless. You don't use more experimental precision than bears on the topic at hand. Now, there may come a time, and maybe it's already come, when linguists ought to go beyond this level of precision. I think there's some reason to believe that, and should think about more sharper experiments that separate out things that we may be mixing up and so on. If so, fine, you do better experiments. But there's no, you know, there's no break between the psychologist who's doing it with a tachistoscope and statistics and a white coat and, you know, a collection of subjects and so on, and the linguist who's just asking their friends. It's all ways of getting data that you can use as evidence. And I presume that's the origin of the distinction, maybe something else. But whatever it is, it's a kind of very radical dualism and an extremely sharp departure from the natural sciences. It's hard to imagine, in fact, a sharper departure. And again, this is quite common. You know, this is accepted across a broad range as meaningful. Throughout the cognitive sciences, for example, there's lots and lots of material that claims that if linguists want to really establish their theories, they're going to have to get psychological evidence. The linguistic evidence won't do. So they'll have to get evidence from, say, click studies, which are completely meaningless. Their only significance is that there's a way of interpreting them so that they correlate with the linguistic evidence. Apart from that, they have no significance at all. But that's what people are going to have if they want to make claims about the truth about the brain in terms of its computational properties and so on and so forth. Again, these are very strange moves from a naturalistic point of view, but they are intelligible in terms of a kind of radical methodological dualism, which states that you're just not allowed to study humans the way you study every other creature in the world, by stipulation. Well, another issue that arises in this connection, and that's, again, all over the place, is the matter of access to consciousness. This plays a big role in philosophy of mind and cognitive science. And so I'll give a number of different examples. One place where this shows up is in a distinction that's supposed to exist between psychological hypotheses and philosophical explanations. Again, the discussion is usually framed in terms of problems of the theory of meaning, but that's only for historical reasons. To the extent that the considerations make any sense, they would apply to the study of sound and the study of syntax and the study of everything else. Okay. It just happens that the tradition out of which they come has largely been concerned with meaning rather than phonetics, but the arguments are the same throughout. Let's take another very influential contemporary philosopher, Michael Dummett from Oxford, who's one of the major modern philosophers of language and mind. Dummett has argued repeatedly over the years that we have to make a crucial distinction in epistemology and metaphysics and so on between psychological hypotheses and philosophical explanations. And here's the way it works. Let's suppose that the naturalistic approach is so successful, we'll now pretend that it's successful way beyond our fondest dreams, and suppose that it's so successful that it's able to give a complete naturalistic account of what happens when a signal strikes the ear and, you know, then gets computed through the perceptual system and the brain and feeds into a theory of action and leads to a certain action. Okay, suppose we have a theory that accounts for that whole chain. Suppose further that we've solved the unification problem. That is, we've shown how this theory of what the brain is doing relates to an account of what cells are doing, you know, cellular activities and chemical interactions between them and so on. So we've solved the unification problem. We have a complete theory of language going from signals all the way up to actions. Okay, let's say we've gotten that far. Well, in that case, Dummett tells us, we would have a psychological hypothesis. That is, the theory that we had constructed would be a psychological hypothesis about people. but it would not be a philosophical explanation. And the reason is, I'm quoting, because it would not tell us the form in which the body of knowledge is delivered. Remember that part of the theory, one part of this theory, which goes from signal hitting the brain, this is Peter over here, to some action. One part of it, when you tear it apart, is inside Peter's brain, a cognitive system, which is an eye language, in fact, it seems, which stores the knowledge. And that's accessed by the performance systems. It's accessed by the perceptual apparatus and by the theory of action and so on. And Dummett's point is that even though you had a perfect theory of this by scientific standards, it would not tell us the form in which the knowledge is delivered. The idea is that in Peter's eye language, in the cognitive system, there is knowledge stored. And Peter's mind accesses that knowledge to hear and to act and so on. But we don't know the form in which the knowledge is delivered to Peter. Okay, that's the idea. It's only if we knew the form in which the knowledge is delivered that we would have a philosophical explanation, not merely a psychological hypothesis. And the argument is framed particularly in connection with the theory of meaning. So that's what Dummett is naturally interested in, being a philosopher. He says if we talk about Peter's knowledge that, say, these sentences here mean what they do, we could have a psychological... I mean, suppose that my theory gave a complete scientific explanation of this distinction that I described a minute ago, which explains how Peter understands these sentences. So it's a theory of meaning. According to Dummett, that complete theory would be a psychological hypothesis about Peter's knowledge of meaning, but it would not be a philosophical explanation, and it would not permit us, it would not justify us in attributing knowledge to Peter. We would not be able to say that Peter knows the rules that lead to this conclusion. There are certain principles of the brain that lead to that distinction over here. Just to give them a name, call them binding theory. There's a part of linguistic theory called binding theory that deals with problems of this kind. And it has various principles in it which predict that things ought to come out like this across all languages. Okay, and in the psychological hypothesis, we're now pretending that everything we believe is true and even that we've gotten way beyond what we now begin to understand. But that's okay. That's permitted in this intellectual exercise. So we're now pretending that binding theory is in fact true and part of a comprehensive theory which is true, and it leads to the conclusion that for Peter, these two sentences are interpreted exactly the way Peter interprets them. But we're still not permitted to attribute to Peter knowledge of binding theory. We're not allowed to say Peter knows the principles of binding theory, even though binding theory is part of his cognitive system, which is accessed when he acts. Obviously, when you act, you access your knowledge or your beliefs. But we're not allowed to say that in the case of Peter. The reason we're not allowed to say it is that the reason why, as Dummett puts it, we don't know the form in which the body of knowledge is delivered is that Peter can't tell us that he is following the principles of binding theory. In other words, if we have this kind of evidence about Peter, but if I ask Peter, are you following condition C of the binding theory, he can't say. And in fact, even if Peter is a linguist and knows what it is, you can't introspect and say, oh yeah, that's the computation that's going on in my head. You can't do that any more than if somebody asked you how you digest your food. You know, you couldn't introspect and say, okay, I do it the way the biologists say. You know? Or if somebody asks you, how do you perceive a triangle? You can't introspect and say, I do it the way the visual psychologists claim I do it. Well, the binding theory is just like that. It's not available to introspection. Therefore, we don't have knowledge of the form in which we don't know the form in which the body of knowledge is delivered, and therefore we don't have a philosophical explanation. Notice that for science, the account that we're talking about to tells us everything that can be asked, by assumption, it tells us everything that can possibly be asked about the form in which the knowledge is delivered. It's answered every question. We've assumed that it's answered every question that science can raise, but it hasn't crossed some bridge to philosophical explanation. Well, this seems, again, like a paradigm example of some kind of philosophical dualism. In the case of digestion or visual perception, we don't say the motion of the planets, we don't insist on a philosophical explanation that goes beyond what science can deliver. That would be a joke. I mean, there was a time when people used to insist on that, but that's long gone. We now say, look, what science can deliver ends the story. But in the case of the human beings above the neck, so language, we're not allowed to do that. Now, presumably, though Dummett doesn't say so, the same would hold for sound. The same argument applies. So if I conclude that Peter judges that pin rhymes with bin, and I make up a perfect theory that explains this, that would not tell me the form in which the knowledge is delivered, and I wouldn't be able to attribute to Peter knowledge of the principles of phonology, which led to that consequence, no matter how well confirmed the theory was, and no matter how well it was unified with cellular theories. I still would have only a psychological explanation. Well, that's a very curious position. And to see how to extend the oddity of it, let's push it a little further. Suppose that there's a Martian who happens to be exactly like us. He works exactly the way we do, understands everything the way we do, has the same brain, the same theory of our brain applies to his brain. In fact, he does everything exactly the way we do. There's only one difference. The Martian has access to the Martian, the rules of binding theory are accessible to consciousness. And in fact, all the rules of the I language are accessible to consciousness. Okay, he's exactly like us, but he has a kind of an inner eye that inspects his internal computations and sees what they're doing. So if I ask the Martian, I give the Martian these sentences, and he makes the same judgments that we do by assumption, and then I ask the Martian, look, think about it, have you applied condition C of the binding theory? And the Martian sort of thinks for a while and says, oh yeah, that's exactly what I did. You know, just as if somebody asked you how you multiplied two numbers. You know, you might introspect for a while and say, yeah, I did it this way. Okay, the Martian can do that for condition B, C of the binding theory. And similarly, if the Martian says this rhymes with that, and I say, look, did you follow the rules of, you know, metrical phonology? He can introspect and think about it and say, yeah, those are the rules that I followed. And let's say he's even telling the truth. So he then can see the computations, just as we can introspect about the computations when we carry out a particular algorithm to solve an arithmetical problem rather than some different one. That's the only difference between the Martian and us. Now, notice for the Martian, we have a philosophical explanation of the form in which the knowledge is delivered. We've crossed this mysterious bridge because the Martian has access to consciousness. Now, in fact, we know nothing of any relevance about the Martian beyond what we know about the human, except that the Martian has this inner eye that we don't have that enables him to inspect the computations. But we're allowed to attribute knowledge to the Martian, and we're not allowed to attribute knowledge to the humans. Well, again, this simply departs radically from any approach in terms of the sciences, at least. As far as the sciences are concerned, the Martian and the human behave exactly the same way. The Martian happens to have access to computations that the human doesn't. That's an interesting question. You know, what is consciousness? What does it mean to have consciousness? Fine question. But it has nothing to do with the problem of whether Peter and the Martian are following the same rules or have the same knowledge or whatever, just irrelevant. Nevertheless, that's considered critical. The same distinction shows up in another area, what's called first-person authority. That's the technical term for it. The idea is that when I say that his mother, and his mother thinks that John is intelligent, he could be referring to John. I say that with what's called first-person authority. I have supreme authority over that judgment. Nobody can question it, okay? I have special privileged knowledge of that fact. As I have first-person authority when I look at the room and see a bunch of people. That's first-person authority. Similarly, the Martian has first-person authority when he makes the same judgments. But according to the theory, we have an account for, we have an explanation for first-person authority in the case of the Martian. Okay, namely, he can tell us, he follows the laws. But in the case of the human, the theory that I've given, this, say, perfect theory, I'm quoting now, leaves the question of Peter's first-person authority a total mystery. Okay, it's left a total mystery because Peter has no access to a consciousness. That's quoting, in this case, an interesting article by Crispin Wright, another Oxford philosopher. Well, as far as I can see, from a naturalistic point of view, that's the wrong formulation. The theory of Peter doesn't leave first person. It doesn't make first person authority a total mystery. It leaves a mystery exactly where it was before. Namely, it leaves the mystery of consciousness. Doesn't say anything about that. That's as much a mystery after this theory is completed as it was before. But as far as first-person authority is concerned, there's no mystery whatsoever. Peter understands the sentence this way because that's the way Peter's constructed, period. There's nothing more to say. You're constructed so that you get that interpretation. That's the full account, full total account of first-person authority. There's no further question that can be asked, at least within a naturalistic framework. If something's missing, it must be because of some non-naturalistic requirement. And it would be important to bring out what that requirement is. This discussion is usually framed in slightly different terminology. In this case, the terminology again goes back to Quine, to Wittgenstein as well and others. It's the problem of following rules. So if Peter is using condition C of the binding theory in drawing that conclusion, the linguist would like to say Peter is following the rule, condition C. That's how Peter draws the conclusion that these sentences have the interpretation that they have. Okay. Now, that's supposed to be a big problem. There's supposed to be a big mystery about the notion of following rules. Quine has suggested, again, that we resolve the mystery by making a distinction between two notions of following rules. One is the notion of fitting rules. Rule here is a very broad notion. It includes, for example, law of nature. You know, includes law of nature, principle of grammar, rule of chess. You know, it's a very broad notion. Okay. So Quine suggests that we distinguish between fitting rules or laws and so on, and being guided. By rules. Okay. He said we clarify this mystery by making that distinction. Okay, now how does that work? Well, according to Quine, let's take, say, Kepler's laws of planetary motion, you know, planets move in ellipses and so on. Quine says we should say that the planets fit the rules. They fit Kepler's laws, but they aren't guided by Kepler's laws. So the planet doesn't think, you know, I'd like to follow Kepler's laws, so therefore I'll move over here. Okay. Rather, the planet just acts in such a way that it fits the laws. Okay. On the other hand, a person is guided by rules, and this is only people, if the person consciously explains that that's what I'm doing. So, for example, if I'm driving a car and there's a red light and I stop and somebody says, what did you do? And I think about it, and I say, well, there's a law, there's a rule that says you're supposed to stop when there's a red light, and that's what I did. I followed that rule. If that description is in fact true, then we can say that the person's guided by the rule. So those are the two categories. You're guided by rules when you can say truly that those are the rules you're following, and otherwise you just fit rules, nothing else. Notice that this excludes Peter. Peter, who is the linguist would like to say, the scientist would like to say, is following the rules of binding theory, certainly isn't guided by them. He can't tell you that that's what he's doing. The Martian is guided by them because he can say so, but Peter isn't. So all we're allowed to say in this case is that Peter fits the rules the way the planets fit Kepler's laws. We're not allowed to say that these rules are part of Peter's cognitive system and that he accesses them and so on. In other words, this perfect theory that we had, we pretended that we had a perfect theory of this, we got to throw it out, okay? Because that theory goes beyond fitting. It actually attributes the rules to Peter. But according to Quine's notion, no matter how successful that theory is, you know, it can achieve perfect success from a scientific point of view, but we have to throw it out anyway. And all we're allowed to say of Peter is that he follows the rules of binding theory, but they're not part of his constitution. Okay, that's the stipulation. Now, here too, there are some very curious moves. In fact, there are even some curious moves about fitting rules. So take the example of Kepler's laws. Actually, the astronomer, the physicist, doesn't just say the planets fit Kepler's laws. What the physicist does is attribute to the planets a certain property, namely mass. The physicist attributes mass to the planets. That's a property. The physicist states certain laws, say Newton's laws. And then it follows that because the planets have the property mass, given Newton's laws, it's going to behave in accordance with Kepler's laws. I mean, that's the actual step that's made. So the analog over here, in the case of Peter, if we want to say that Peter just fits the laws of binding theory, we have to do what the physicist does. We have to attribute to Peter some property from which it will follow by the laws of nature that Peter draws those conclusions. That would be treating Peter like the planets. Well, what property do we attribute to Peter? We could attribute to him mass, but nothing's going to follow from that. I mean, from attributing to Peter mass, it's not going to follow that he interprets these sentences this way. So that's not enough. We have to attribute to Peter richer properties than that. Well, in fact, for a scientist, the properties that you would attribute to Peter are the properties stated by the structure of this theory. You would say that I'm attributing to Peter a property of having a brain with language faculty and a cognitive system which includes binding theory and a performance system which accesses it and so on. That whole complex of material is the property that I'm attributing to Peter, just as I attribute mass to the planets. If some thing up there in the sky didn't have mass, it wouldn't follow Kepler's laws. And if Peter didn't have this structure, it wouldn't follow the laws of nature and yield these conclusions. However, we're not allowed to make that move in the case of Peter, again, by stipulation, another form of radical dualism. In fact, when people talk about following rules, it's within the category of fitting rules, but where you're allowed to attribute to the person the properties which would account for why they fit the rules. And by stipulation, the linguist and the psychologist are not allowed to do this. I mean, maybe the psychologist, but not the linguist. And again, that's a pure dualist stipulation. There's a whole huge literature following this distinction. The person who's developed it furthest is John Searle in a series of articles, and actually a new book, which I haven't seen yet. I think it's just come out. Searle was, he insists strongly, as most philosophers and cognitive scientists do, that access to consciousness is the crucial criterion for attributing rule following. The Wittgensteinians more or less do that too, although it's a little more qualified. But Searle explicitly demands that. His demand is, it's nonsense, it's an absurdity to speak of Peter following rules unless Peter can tell you that that's what he's doing. So we're not allowed to do what the scientist would do in this case. Okay. Now, Searle, however, has recognized that there are certain, you know, kind of paradoxes that follow from this insistence. One thing that's bothered him is a phenomenon that in the psychological literature is called blindsight. It was discovered some years ago that if a person suffers a certain kind of damage to the visual cortex, say maybe some part of the visual cortex is removed, then in some area of the visual field, the person has no awareness of seeing anything, looks blank. On the other hand, under some cases, it turns out that you can show experimentally that the person really is seeing something. So if you take the area, suppose the person, this is the area of the visual field for which some person who's had a brain operation has no awareness. And if you draw in there, let's say, a cross or a circle,